And indeed there was on it a very great number of elephants, for there was ample grazing land for all the other creatures too, whether they lived in marshes, lakes, and rivers, or roamed the mountains and the plains, and likewise for this animal, the largest and hungriest of all. Besides this, whatever fragrant things the earth produces even today, roots, grasses, trees, or oozing saps, whether from flowers or fruits, the island bore all these and nourished them well. And also the cultivated crop, the dry grain that serves us for food, and those other plants we use alongside grain, all of whose kinds we call by the single name pulses, and the tree fruit which provides drink and food and oils, the fruit of the orchard trees, hard to store, grown for pleasure and amusement. And all the after-dinner treats we set out as welcome relief for a person who has had enough. All of these that island, then lying beneath the sun, brought forth in sacred, beautiful, and wondrous abundance without limit. Taking all these things from the earth, they built their temples, royal dwellings, harbors, and shipyards, and furnished the whole rest of the country, arranging it in the following order. First they bridged over the rings of sea that surrounded the ancient mother city, building a road out from the palace and toward it. They had built the palace, right from the beginning, within this very dwelling place of the god and their ancestors. And each ruler, receiving it from the one before, added his own adornments to what was already adorned, always trying to outdo his predecessor as far as he could, until they had made the dwelling a thing to marvel at for the size and beauty of its work. Beginning from the sea, they cut a canal 300 feet wide, 100 feet deep and 50 stads long, all the way through to the outermost ring, so as to make it into a harbor by allowing ships to sail up from the sea to that ring, and they cut its mouth wide enough for the largest ships to sail through. And they also cut passages through the rings of land that separated the rings of sea, at the points of the bridges, wide enough for a single trireme to pass from one to the next, and roofed these passages over so that the water flowed beneath, for the banks of the landrings rose well above the level of the sea. The largest of the rings, into which the sea had been cut through, was 3 stads wide, and the landring next to it was equal to it in width. Of the second pair, the ring of water was 2 stads wide, and the ring of land again equal to the watering before it, and the ring running around the central island itself was 1 stad wide. The island on which the palace stood had a diameter of 5 stads. This island, together with the rings of water and land and the bridge, which was a plethron wide, they enclosed all around with a stone wall, setting towers and gates at every point where the bridges crossed the water. They quarried the stone from beneath the central island itself and from the outer and inner sides of the rings, some white, some black, and some red. And as they quarried, they hollowed out at the same time double docks roofed over with the living rock. Of their buildings, some were plain, but in others they wove together stones of different colors for pleasure's sake, giving themselves an enjoyment that came naturally with the work. The entire circuit of the wall around the outermost ring they overlaid with bronze, applying it like a coat of paint. The wall of the inner ring they coated with tin, and the wall around the Acropolis itself with orichalcum, which flashed with a fiery gleam. The palace within the Acropolis was arranged as follows. At its center stood a holy sanctuary, forbidden to enter, dedicated to Cleito and Poseidon, enclosed by a wall of gold. This was the very place where the race of the 10 royal lines had first been conceived and born. And here, every year, from all 10 territories, they brought offerings in their season for each of those ancestors. There was also a temple of Poseidon himself, a stade in length, 300 feet wide and proportionate in height to match, though with something of a foreign look to it. The whole exterior of the temple they coated with silver, except for the figures at its peaks, which were of gold. Inside, the ceiling was entirely of ivory, adorned throughout with gold, silver, and orichalcum, while all the rest, the walls, columns, and floor, they covered with orichalcum. They set up golden statues, the god himself standing on a chariot, driving 6 winged horses, so large that his head touched the ceiling above, and around him 100 nereids riding on dolphins, for that was thought to be their number in those days, and many other statues stood within as well, offerings from private citizens. Around the outside of the temple stood golden images of all the kings and their wives, descended from the 10 original rulers, along with many other great offerings from kings and private citizens alike, both from the city itself and from all the lands under its rule. The altar matched this scale and workmanship in its size, and the palace too was fitted both to the greatness of the empire and to the splendor fitting for the temples. As for the springs, the cold one and the warm one, they had an inexhaustible supply, and the water of each was wonderfully suited by its pleasantness and its quality to its particular use. They built around them, setting up structures and plantings of trees suited to the waters, and also basins, some open to the sky, others roofed over for warm baths in winter, separate ones for the kings, separate ones for private citizens, and still others for the women, and others again for the horses and other beasts of burden, each fitted out appropriately for its use. The overflow they channeled to the Grove of Poseidon, where trees of every kind grew to a marvelous height and beauty because of the richness of the soil, and from there they led it through conduits to the outer rings, crossing the bridges. Their many temples had been built for many gods, and many gardens and many gymnasiums, some for men, some for horses, laid out separately on each of the two ring islands. And in particular, at the center of the larger island, a racetrack had been set aside for them, a stadium wide, and its whole length ran around the circle, left open for the horses to race in. On either side of it stood barracks for the great number of the royal guard. The more trusted of them were stationed on garrison duty on the smaller ring, which lay closer to the Acropolis, while those judged most trustworthy of all had dwellings assigned to them within the Acropolis itself, around the persons of the kings. The dockyards were full of triremes, and all the equipment triremes need, all of it well supplied. Such, then, was the arrangement around the dwelling of the kings. Crossing the three outer harbors, beginning from the sea, one came upon a wall running in a circle, everywhere 50 stadia distant from the largest ring and harbor, and it closed in upon itself at the mouth of the canal that opened to the sea. The whole of this space was thickly settled with many dwellings, and the channel and the great harbor teemed with ships and merchants arriving from every quarter, so many that by day and by night there rose from their multitude a great confusion of voices, noise, and clatter. So much, then, for the city and the region around the ancient dwelling, recalled now much as it was described then. As for the rest of the country, I must try to recall what its natural character was and how it was arranged. To begin with, the whole region was said to be very high and to fall steeply to the sea, but the area around the city was all plain, itself enclosed in a ring by mountains that ran down all the way to the sea, smooth and level, and oblong altogether, 3,000 stadia long on one side, and 2,000 from the sea up to the middle on the other. This whole area faced south, on that side of the island, and was sheltered from the north winds. The mountains surrounding it were celebrated in those days as surpassing in number, size, and beauty all that exist now, containing within them many wealthy villages of country folk, and rivers, lakes, and meadows providing ample fodder for every kind of animal, tame and wild, and timber abundant and varied both in quantity and in kind, sufficient for every use and every need. Such was the plain, shaped as it was by nature and worked further over a long time by many kings. It was, to begin with, four-sided, mostly straight-edged and oblong, and where it fell short of this, a ditch had been dug around it to correct the shape. As for the depth, width, and length of this ditch, they seem past believing for a work made by hand, on top of all the other labors, but I must tell what we were told. It had been dug to a depth of a plethron, and its width was uniformly 1 stadium, and since it was dug around the whole plain, it worked out to a length of 10,000 stadia. It received the streams flowing down from the mountains, and circling around the plain and reaching the city from both directions, it was there let out to flow into the sea. From its upper part, canals about 100 feet wide were cut straight through the plain and led back again into the ditch on the seaward side, each one spaced 100 stadia from the next. Through these they brought down the timber from the mountains to the city, and carried other seasonal produce by boat as well, cutting cross channels from one canal to another and toward the city. And they harvested the land twice a year, using the rains from Zeus in winter, and in summer drawing on the water brought in from the canals to nourish whatever the earth produces. As for numbers, the men in the plain fit for war were organized, so that each allotment supplied one man as a commanding officer, the size of each allotment being 10 by 10 stadia, and the allotments together numbered 60,000. As for those from the mountains and the rest of the country, their number was said to be beyond counting, and all of them were assigned, by district and village, to these allotments under their respective commanders. Each commander was required to furnish for war a sixth part of a war chariot, so as to make up 10,000 chariots in all, plus two horses and their riders, and in addition a pair of horses without a chariot, along with a combat rider bearing a small shield and a charioteer to manage the pair mounted behind the two riders, also two hoplites, and two archers and two slingers each, three light-armed stone throwers and three javelin throwers each, and four sailors to help crew 1,200 ships. Such was the war organization of the royal city. The other nine cities were organized differently, each in its own way, which would take too long to tell. As for the offices and honors, they had been arranged from the beginning as follows. Each of the 10 kings ruled, within his own portion and over his own city, the men and most of the laws, punishing and putting to death whomever he wished. But their rule over one another and their partnership followed the instructions of Poseidon, as the law had handed down to them, and as was inscribed by the first kings on a pillar of Orichalc, which stood at the center of the island in the temple of Poseidon. There they gathered every fifth year, and alternately every sixth, giving equal weight to the even and the odd, and when they were gathered they deliberated on matters of common concern, examined whether anyone had transgressed, and passed judgment. And whenever they were about to pass judgment, they first gave one another pledges of the following kind. With bulls running loose in the temple of Poseidon, the 10 kings, left alone together, prayed to the god to help them catch the victim pleasing to him, and hunted the bulls with clubs and nooses alone, without iron. And whichever bull they caught, they led up to the pillar and slaughtered over its top, upon the inscription. And on the pillar, besides the laws, there was an oath calling down great curses upon those who disobeyed. So then, when they had sacrificed according to their own laws and were consecrating all the limbs of the bull, they mixed a bowl of wine and cast in a clot of blood for each king, and carried the rest to the fire, after first cleansing the pillar all around. Then, drawing wine from the bowl in golden cups, they poured a libation over the fire and swore an oath to give judgment according to the laws written on the pillar, and to punish anyone found to have transgressed them before, and thereafter never willingly to transgress any of the writings themselves, nor to rule or to obey a ruler except in accordance with the laws of their father. Each of them, having made this prayer for himself and his line, drank, and dedicated his cup in the temple of the god, then spent the time until dinner and other necessities. When darkness had come and the fire around the sacrifice had cooled, all of them put on the most beautiful dark blue robes they had, and sat on the ground by the embers of the oath sacrifices, by night, extinguishing every fire around the temple, and there they were judged and gave judgment on any charge one might bring against another for transgression. And when judgment had been given, at daybreak they wrote the verdicts on a golden tablet and set it up as a memorial along with their robes. There were many other laws particular to the privileges of each of the kings, but the greatest were these: never to take up arms against one another, and all to come to the aid of any one of them if someone in any of the cities attempted to overthrow the royal line, and to deliberate in common, as their forefathers had, on matters of war and other undertakings, granting the leadership to the line of Atlas. And no king was to have power of death over any of his kinsmen, unless more than half of the 10 agreed. Such was the great power that existed then in that region, which the god arranged and brought to bear upon these regions here, for some such reason as the following, so the story goes. For many generations, so long as the god's nature was enough to sustain them, they were obedient to the laws and kindly disposed toward the divine to which they were akin. For they possessed true and in every way great-souled thoughts, using gentleness joined with wisdom, both toward the fortunes that continually befell them and toward one another. And so, judging everything except virtue to be of little account, they thought lightly of their present prosperity and bore the weight of gold and their other possessions as a mere burden. They were not intoxicated by luxury, nor did they lose mastery of themselves through wealth and stumble because of it. But soberly and clearly they saw that all these things too grow through common friendship joined with virtue, while by eager pursuit of possessions and by honoring them, both these very things and the friendship perish along with them. By reasoning of this kind, and while their divine nature remained undiminished, everything grew for them as we have already described. But when the portion of the God within them began to grow faint, worn thin by repeated mixture with much that was mortal, and the human temperament gained mastery, then, no longer able to bear their prosperity, they began to behave shamefully, and to one who could see clearly they appeared base, since they were destroying what was most admirable among the things they held most precious. While to those unable to see what a truly happy life is, they seemed at that very time to be supremely beautiful and blessed, filled as they were with unjust greed and power. And Zeus, god of gods, ruling by law, since he could discern such things clearly, took note of this once decent race now wretchedly disposed, and wishing to inflict punishment on them so that, chastened, they might become more measured, gathered all the gods together into their most honored dwelling, which stands at the center of the whole universe and looks down upon all things that share in becoming. And having assembled them, he said,